Hello and welcome to the PC Gamer Bioshock Infinite spoiler podcast special thing. I'm Chris Thurston and today I am joined by Tom Francis, who reviewed the game and has subsequently left us, sort of, maybe.
Yes, for 3 months I've temporarily left you.
Temporarily leaving man Tom Francis. Editor Graham Smith, who finished it last night.
Yeah, so my feelings on the matter are the least developed, which is always true, to be honest, but...
We'll do what we can. And Marsh Davies, who
Hi.
Is here.
Yeah.
That's the best you can say about him.
He's the ever physically present.
Certainly here. Yeah. I've finished ages ago, so my opinions have been gestating and or stagnating.
Yeah, fermenting for
a big, gaseous, horrible boil full of opinion.
Burst me, Chris.
Pop you. I finished it last week and very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, so I think it's probably worth saying everybody around this table enjoyed it. We're probably all going to say bad things about it, which may make it sound like we didn't.
But we loved it. We all loved it.
I think in many ways the most sensible format for discussing the game, to point out if you're listening, we're not just simply going to discuss the ending and interpretations of it and how it works. We're going to try and take in the entire game because I think it's actually one of the most spoilable games I've ever played. I think it's the less you know going in about how the tears work, how you know what Columbia even is, the better the whole experience is. So we will probably take in the entire experience. But I think the way to do that is to talk about things we didn't like.
Tom should start since he reviewed the game, right?
And has the most developed experience and also notes.
What I have is when I was reviewing it, as you'll know, presumably if you're listening this far, you've already completed it, because if you haven't, then you should stop immediately. And so you will know that as certain things are happening in the game, you're kind of desperate to talk to someone about it, because A, it's really shocking and surprising, you know, there's loads of cool twists and like, oh my god moments, but B, some of them you have questions about perhaps, which is, wait a minute, what? That doesn't make any sense. And so because I was reviewing it, it wasn't out yet, and so there was a limited pool of people I could talk to. And so really it was just two other reviewers, Craig Owens and John Blythe. And so I don't actually have notes, I've just pasted the chat log that I had with Craig Owens, where I went through like, well, what about this? Well, why is this happening? Hang on, what about that? And it was quite edifying, actually. There's some stuff where he was able to sort of explain it, like make it a bit more satisfactory to me. Most of it, we all just agreed, no, that doesn't make any sense. There's no satisfactory explanation for this. And then some stuff, he agreed there wasn't an explanation for it, but it didn't bother him as much as it bothered me. The biggest thing, I don't know, it feels weird not to talk about why I like the game.
Should we describe the game?
Well, I mean, I assume that someone's
listening. What is? Yeah.
I mean, no one should be listening to this who hasn't played it.
Indeed.
Right. Yeah. And it's a very good game, and I would recommend that pretty much anyone who doesn't mind violent shooters... should play it.
I'll just quickly summarise why I liked it and then...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think for the sake of discussion as well, like, why you do and don't like things is pretty key to that, and the things you look for in games versus the things you don't, go ahead.
Obviously, it was fucking fantastic. I love having, like, a really spectacular, gorgeous and properly original place to explore. Like, you know, there have been cities flying around and other things, but I've still never seen anything quite like Columbia. And just that, I mean, the whole... Once you leave the lighthouse, like your actual arrival in Columbia, the next like 30 to 40 minutes is just perfect. It's just staggeringly perfect. Like, I've never seen anything like it. Even films haven't made experiences that cinematic. It's just like coming out into, the chapel is incredible in itself, and just that wonderful atmosphere of the gospel music ringing out through the corridors and the sloshing through the water and all those candles glowing, and the atmosphere of that was amazing. And then just when you're out in Columbia itself, like the feeling of being in like a village fate. It's really like lovely place. There aren't many lovely places in gaming. It's usually like utterly surreal or utterly hellish. And this is like, you know, everyone's dressed up nice and they're having picnics on the lawn and
nice racist.
They are a bit racist.
Yeah, that isn't in.
Only
that
eating white bread.
That only kicks in after that 30 to 40 minutes. And that's kind of, you know, that's great in itself because it sugars you up to get you kind of liking the place before they hit you with that. So mostly the main thing I loved about it was just the sense of adventure and also like the sense of mystery and just figuring out, like, they throw so many little hints at you that things are a bit weird. Like just the AD thing, the thing in the back of your hand, it's like you just have no hope of working that out. It's like, I mean, you can guess at what the initials stand for, but just the, like, there are so many, that thing alone raises about 11 different questions. Like, oh, why do I have that? How do they know I have that? What does it mean? Why am I here? I love that sense of mystery. And then I also really enjoyed the combat. At first, I really didn't like it, the combat. The first bits where you're just shooting with guns, I don't like the guns particularly, and you just feel like you have no options and you're kind of got slightly irritated with it at that point. But then the more vigors you get, the cooler they get. And weirdly, like, even the vigors I already had became much more interesting as I unlocked other ones. Like, at first I got the crows and the fire and bucking bronco, and when I got them, they all three seemed to do pretty much the same thing, like disable a big bunch of people and damage them all a bit. Like, you know, the devil's kiss sets them on fire, and while they're burning they can't move and they're taking damage, and then crows peck them, and while they're being pecked they can't move and they take a bit of damage, and then bucking bronco sends them up in the air, and while they're in the air they can't move. But then as you obviously, like, you buy upgrades for them, and that makes them, they all have something interesting about them. Like the crows, I love setting crows on fire. And bucking bronco, it turns out if you get the thing that lets it chain to other people, you start to realize that actually it costs almost no salts because a tiny, tiny amount. So it's really, really cost efficient way of just disabling everybody, just getting everybody up in the air. And then also you can use it as a kind of poor man's undertow before you get undertow, because once they're in the air, if you shoot them, they like react physically. So you can knock them off the edge of Columbia. So I kept discovering loads of cool stuff like that about the combat.
I didn't discover half of that.
Me either.
Yeah.
My biggest problem was basically that I was really excited about these mysteries and I kept trying to figure out ways of making sense of them. And then at the end, I felt like the explanation for many of them was just completely arbitrary and pulled out of the middle of nowhere. And even if there is a way to formulate a sort of system of rules where the ending makes sense, it's so... they're rules that you haven't been told and rules that come from nowhere, so the dramatic impact was all drained out of it because of that.
I mean, maybe without going like really deep into the ending straight away, but we could do. I really liked, and I think this is maybe a different approach to like storytelling or like thinking about storytelling more than anything else, plot holes don't really bother me, right? Like, they don't. Because what's more important is the effect of the story, the way, the atmosphere, the events, whether they hold together thematically, philosophically, anything else. I finished it. I think I was probably the second person in the office to finish it. And I emailed you immediately afterwards because I needed to talk to somebody. As you know, you got your chat log there. I needed to write it down to somebody. And the thing that had... I'd be interested actually to know which particular aspects of the end you thought were... Maybe we need to be
got
specific.
A list right here.
Yeah, we need to be specific. But to bounce it off an experience. So I suspected that... I mean, serious spoilers from now on. Seriously, if you're still listening. Seriously. I suspected that... Booker was Comstock from quite early in the game. And
I had that thought as well.
It was. I had a disappointing realization. I was like, oh, really? Oh, it's going to, yeah, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, but you're disappointed by everything. So
yes, this is true, yeah.
But just to finish, so just in terms of as the effect that I had kind of, and I'm sure that that's the experience I was kind of meant to have, because the clues are so, like, as someone who listens, tries to find every audio diary and whatever, the clues are left, they're very much there. They're not accidental clues. You're not guessing it because you're trying to think of what kinds of twists there might be. You are following the clues that are explicitly laid for you in a breadcrumb trail.
It's when we did the box out in my preview where I played the first 5 hours and I didn't want to, I couldn't spoil anything because I didn't know the answer to any mysteries, but we did a box out of like, let's all just pick the most ridiculous twist we think are going to happen. Like, you're a ghost and everyone's all the same person, we're all microscopic, and Booker is Comstock is one of them.
Yeah.
And I don't think it went into the final box out. I think it's one of the ones I scrapped.
The ghost one is not that far wrong.
When the ghost showed up, I was like, oh, for fuck's
sake. We can talk about the fucking ghost later on. We probably will all agree on that. So therefore, the experience at the very end, my only frustration with it really was the fact that it took so long for Booker to get it. Because, like, you know, there's so many clues. Like the bit where it triggered for me was during the Hall of Heroes bit, Cornelius Slate, who's the only character in the entire game who knew Booker at the one point when both Comstock and Booker were Booker, right, during a Battle of Wounded Knee, calls you the White Sioux of, I think it's the White Sioux, or like the White Indian of Knee or whatever. Whatever it is, because Booker took scalps and was this sort of like monstrous presence on the battlefield kind of thing. And later on, like in a side shop, there's an audio diary of Comstock's where he's drunk and talking about how it wasn't until Wounded Knee that people took him seriously because of his Native American heritage. And I thought that was really kind of interesting because that whole thing in... I thought that was really clever. Like, I really like this aspect of the storytelling because, you know, you're used to, from a Bioshock game, having these kind of oligarch sort of ideologue, like Andrew Ryan, Zachary Comstock, who explicitly mythologize themselves. And you can go through the entire Hall of Heroes thing, and it all holds together completely fine with the idea that Comstock has just inserted himself into history, right? That holds together perfectly as part of the plot. Slate's account, Slate's opinion on what's happened makes complete sense, right? Which is that Comstock has hijacked history, Booker DeWitt and Comstock aren't the same person, and Booker, who is now arriving, the irony of Slate and the tragedy of Slate's death then becomes that he's kind of willing to be killed by Booker, but not by Comstock, even though they're the same person. That's kind of, and it's only when they then throw that diary in that you'd have, in a situation where Comstock would have no reason to lie, that it kind of throws the entire thing off and how both of these people have filled the same role in the same battle. And I thought that was really cleverly done, actually, as a way of teasing what happens at the end. The weakness I think about the ending is that it's only in that final baptism scene, even after Booker's already drowned Comstock in a baptismal font, that Booker figures it out. And, you know, the last line, I think it's a beautifully delivered last line, the both thing. But yeah,
it's pretty on the nose.
See, like,
I'm Booker, just, I'm Zachary, I'm both.
Even with a series of very strange events happening in your life, for example, a woman who can open transdimensional tears and a flying city, you wouldn't necessarily think that the antagonist, who is an old man with a big beard, and think, oh, you're just me. You wouldn't necessarily leap to that conclusion.
Well, I think that's the problem with the game. Like, I mean, I actually don't mind the way that the story unravels, but I have a fundamental problem with the idea that Booker could ever become Comstock. That just seems extremely glib to me. And I know people
They do
have.
Actually look quite similar. Like, it means you've
got No. I'm not talking about the evidence of it. I'm talking about the idea that a single life-changing event can make you either... a kind of roguish PI figure who's actually got a heart of gold, or or a guy who wants to rain fire on man is a massive racist and a crazy religious dude. I just don't buy that. I can buy it via the narrative, but it just seems extremely glib. Like, and that's made all the more aggravating by the fact that I know you're not playing Booker. I mean, like, the Booker character is a character by himself, and he's not you. In the game, but right near the beginning of the game, you are expected to express your character through Booker in that first choice where you either throw the baseball.
Yeah.
And after it's allowed you to do that, to then just kind of pull the rug out from underneath you and say, actually, you could become a racist at any point.
Well, I mean, the game establishes, like, that's why it's, that's, I mean, and I maybe end up playing Devil's Advocate here quite a lot, but, like, that's why it establishes Booker's remorse about his time as a Pinkerton agent, right? The fact that he was a union breaker and he was killing, you know, he was aggressively hired to put down industrial action and stuff, that in both timelines, right, in the Comstock timeline, this is the direction that, like, I think it's established fairly clearly that Booker not only has a very violent streak, but that he has a kind of authoritarian kind of, you know, he is capable of dehumanizing people and abusing them, right, in both timelines, like, pretty clearly.
You can say this kind of stuff.
No, but like, it's explicitly there in the story. Yeah.
I think there's kind of two versions of Booker. There's the kind of presentation of him as a roguish PI with the heart of gold, and I think maybe that's there to make him palatable as a protagonist or as a marketing figure. But he's not really the roguish PI with the heart of gold. He's already the monstrous scalping Pinkerton agent who sold his daughter. And a degenerate drunk. Like, he is an absolute monstrous person. And although, yeah, in that instance where you decide to throw the fruit at the guy leading the rabble and not the interracial couple, you know, you then go on to brutally murder and kill hundreds of people after that. And so, like, although in that instance you can say, yes, no, actually I'm not a racist, I'm a decent human being, in every other respect, both your backstory and your actions that you carry out through the game,
the kind of the tenor of that character, the way it's written throughout.
I mean, I think I kind of agree with you actually, Martin, but I think the way of interpreting it is that Booker, the important question the player is asked is where is the extent of Booker's repentance for the person he's previously been. Right, like, regardless of which book you're talking about, he has previously been a complete asshole. And if he gets to Columbia, it's at that point that you establish whether or not Booker is still racist or has subsequently changed, right? And that's kind of expressed in his dialogue to Elizabeth as well, where he's like, there's a bunch of things that I started, so when I, you know, you start following this thing around, you start seeing patterns of it everywhere. Like, Booker DeWitt insists on being called by his first name, whereas Comstock insists on being called by his surname all the time. It's kind of this weird, like, you hear this parallelism. And I think it's kind of, that's, I mean, it's, that's the story's conceit, right? That it's kind of this branch in the same person, but the similar kind of patterns manifest, even if it's sort of the opposite versions. Something that might be relevant to this, I went to the BAFTA thing that Ken Levine did, and something they said in the Q&A that came up, which I think is really interesting, was that it, when they first started playtesting it, there was an aspect of Booker's personality that made everyone playtesting the game completely hate him. And they changed it. They rewrote a bunch of the game.
Do you think he's racist?
No, I think he was religious. That's my guess. This is my best guess. I don't know this for sure, but I was thinking about that.
Like, the central choice is whether he becomes religious or not, isn't it? Baptism. Mm. Like, the Booker is the one who didn't become religious because he didn't go through...
Or maintain some religious belief, right? Like, I mean, but the Booker you get has kind of completely forgone religion, whereas the same story works if, you know, Booker either... Like, actually, I think it probably works better if it's more about how that religion is expressed.
Does anybody try and use the basin in the lighthouse to wash away your sins?
Yes, I did, yeah.
And he refuses to because his sins can't be washed away, which makes perfect sense because he's the version who thought that in the first place. That's why he didn't go to the baptism. He would have if he thought it could absolve him, but he just thought it couldn't be absolved.
Yeah. Like, and that's interesting, and it makes sense, but that then explains why that sign is there. Right, given that lighthouse's only purpose, because it's more of that, it's not like that lighthouse isn't the introduction to Columbia, right? It's not how people get to Columbia. Columbia doesn't take people. It's not like beginning of Bioshock where the lighthouse is there, set up by Andrew Ryan. I've always thought the lighthouse is set up by the Lutesses, right? Like, those questions in the lighthouse basically establish which Booker you're getting.
Hmm.
Right? Like all the sort of his reactions to all that stuff, like the baptismal font and the dead body and everything else, and then the things about the coin flips and everything else. Like, that sense that at the beginning of the game, the Lutesses are establishing what type of Booker they have plucked out of history to throw at Columbia. There's an interesting thing, I told these guys earlier, but the suspicion is that this is attempt 122.
Yeah.
Yeah, because of the amount of checks on the 123, because of the amount of checks on the chalkboard and the code used to enter Columbia and all that stuff. Hmm. And
Is it 123?
It's 122.
122, right.
Like one scroll, one, two swords, two keys.
Right, that's interesting, I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that thing with the flipping the coins, because you can see there's been like 8 or something beforehand, or I think maybe it's 10, and you're like, the next one, and then as he turns around, you see there's another 100 on the back.
Yeah. But also the fact that, like, you know, based on like probability, it's not the results of multiple coin flips, it's the results of the same coin flip multiple times. Because obviously, like, you know, if you flip a coin 122 times, it should come up pretty even. But if you flip the same coin, if you did the same coin flip, like, out of time, then it would always come the same way, which is kind of... that says it right there. That is, it's interesting, like, how right at the beginning of the game basically tells you exactly what is happening.
Hmm. So my problem with the ending was more metaphysical than yours. Because I was just completely unclear on the logic of how the parallel universes work, because you... as they're drowning Booker... Although, what the hell version of Booker they're drowning, I don't know. I was just thinking about, why would this help? That doesn't kill... Like, in every other case, killing someone in one universe doesn't mean there are no universes in which the subsequent versions of them ever exist. So I get that if you kill him before he gets baptized, then that version of Booker won't branch into the other two. But why are we assuming there's no other parallel universe in which Booker exists at all?
Like, well, I think you have to posit that in certain instances, different universe Bookers can coalesce. I think that's the way.
There's a simpler solution to this as well.
Oh, okay.
It's how Elizabeth's power is explained to work, in that it's wish fulfillment, right? Like, bear with me, right? That's not just a wizard did it solution. It's that they need a Booker who wants to end all other Bookers, right? Like, it's the acquiescence, right? It's the choice to end Booker at that point, which is like the third way out of the binary option of the baptism, right? And so it's based on when Elizabeth sort of, she opens that final tear, right? When she takes you to the back to the, and she says like, "Are you sure?" And Booker says, "Yes." I always thought, when I was thinking about it afterwards, I was thinking that's her asking for permission to kind of like make, because Elizabeth's power is to remake reality, right? When she's unbound, it's not just pulling things in from other realities. She just changes reality. And I always assumed that was her permission to kind of like change the rules, essentially, to say like, this Booker has now agreed that this is the future now.
And so she's actually using her power to reach into all possible universes and simultaneously
hence the multiple, hence
except
the multiple
one, because there's one after the credits.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no fucking clue what that means.
But otherwise, then she would be undoing herself, wouldn't she? And then there you create a paradox. Yeah, but then she wouldn't be able to kill Booker. So, I mean, it's kind of... basically, this game has a ghost in it, so I'm not sure how much...
But your argument is invalid.
Well, no, I just kind of think there's only so much worth in unpicking its logic.
I certainly agree with that.
Because it's, you know, ultimately quite a silly fantasy, probably.
Well, I mean, I think it's maybe a little bit dismissive. But...
No, I think there are many, many good things about the game and its narrative. But I would say that metaphysics is probably not one of its strongest points.
Yeah.
I think, as a counter to that, symbolism is one of its very strongest points.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Like, and symbolism has a direct reference to that meta. Like, I think it's. I think basically, if you approach it as a science fiction story, with regards to its time travel and its multiple dimensions and everything else,
it's sliders, not primer.
Right, yeah. But if you approach it as... like a story about sort of different ways of looking at sort of existence and time and things, it actually does hold together symbolically. And it's actually, you know, beautifully well-crafted in that regard. Like, I mean, I loved the beginning, like within and the significance of all of the different images in the chapel at the start. You know, will the circle be unbroken is the message of that, right? You know, that is very explicitly will the message, but that the hymn as well is kind of, in the way it relates to kind of religion and concepts of religious life and the kind of course of religious life versus secularity or anything else, which is deeply unreligious. But also the fact that you start that whole sequence where people are singing about, you know, will there be a life after this, etc., and you're standing in water that is just moving forward, right? And that the whole metaphor of that entire section is just this stream that is dry, that you as the player and as Booker and everything else, despite the soundtrack talking about sensibly circles and circularity, the river you're standing in, and rivers are a really obvious and common metaphor for time, is forwards, right? And it's only forwards. And then the moment you get out of that, the first audio diary you find of Comstock immediately afterwards refers to him as the man standing on the bank, not the man standing in the river. And that's like it's sort of that weird kind of like they start that metaphor for rivers as time and for pools of water as time straight away and play with it really cleverly throughout the whole thing, and that's the most pretentious thing I'll say about it.
It's time yet.
Yeah. It's so like I agree with pretty much everything everyone's saying, but I found it really, I mean, I haven't had a lot of time to think about it because I just finished it last night, but I found it difficult to follow what the game was trying to say about issues of guilt and religious absolution and, you know, that kind of thing, like the recurrent motif of the baptism, and especially in light of the scene after the credits, which seems to imply that
a reality
Booker gets a do-over and remembers somewhat, you know, like the way he says Anna in this panicky, oh God, is she there or not way, opening that door implies that he remembers something of what's just happened before. Has he just essentially been baptized by Elizabeth,
well, since and the now magic mage been lady swept in and just made everything all right.
Yeah, like didn't God just absolve him of his sin and now he's back in his office and he gets a second chance to do it right
by
his daughter?
There's so many ways of interpreting that scene.
Yeah, like that's the problem. Yeah, like I don't like. I feel like the game isn't clear about what it's saying, and I'm not sure that it's a deliberate. We're going to leave this open to interpretation, or oh, we're not saying anything specific. We just want to generate discussion. It feels like it's just so muddled and there are so many things going on that it's really hard to read what it's trying to say.
At that point, I was pretty sick of waking up in that office and going towards that door as well. I've done this like 17 times in this ending now.
I mean, and to be completely, I agree with you. I think it's telling that in my positive interpretation of the ending, I've just sort of pretended that didn't happen. Like, but because post-credit things can be such bullshit, right? Like, I have them reserved in part of my brain reserved for bullshit. And like, I don't really factor them into story. Like, storytelling, like, It had played its final hand by that point. It almost feels like an if you want it, here you go. It's there are plenty, you know, the last year in games has proved that there are plenty of people who won't accept a negative ending or a sad ending or a tragic ending, and it felt like for
so
me
they should
it was
have done after
cop.
Mass Effect 3's credits.
They did. They totally did. Like, and then there is an ending where you Mass Effect 3 spoilers, skip ahead 10 seconds, where you see Shepard's breastplate move as if he's still breathing, right? And that's always been in there, right? They're done. And it's just a cop out, right? It's just the kind of and if you want to try and find a way of wrangling this into being a happy ending, here you go. Otherwise, our work is over here. Like, you know, I don't know.
I did, but yeah, I agree with that portion. To go back to positives, I like, so once you pick it all apart and you know, figure out what's going on, I like that the difference between Booker and Comstock, the version of him who did get baptized and the version of him didn't, like I say, Comstock is not the one who washed his sins away, he's the one who thought his sins could be washed away. And in the Hall of Heroes, like every time anyone asks Booker about his past, he's always like, he just doesn't want to talk about it at all. And he kind of hints that he's done terrible things, but then doesn't want to talk about it. It's interesting that the absolved version of Comstock, the guy who got baptized and feels like he's been born again and he's kind of left his dark past behind, makes a whole fucking monument to it and shows himself like lording it over all these Indians he's slaughtering and saying how cool it is, and all these like speaker announcements saying how great he is and how fantastic it was that he killed all these people. one who didn't get baptized is just deeply ashamed of it, doesn't even want to speak about it.
Its observation of propaganda is extremely good, I think. Okay.
So. Yeah.
I would think if you were looking for a point then, like especially a point regarding religion, it's that, like, it's ultimately the act of sort of regret or repentance or kind of having that consciousness that you can't, like the doubt that your sins can be washed away is actually much more human, that there is a dehumanizing effect to the idea that absolution is as simple as a symbol, right?
Mm.
Like, it's kind of like it's kind of little flourish at the end is the fact that that happens to be the method by which Booker atones is by drowning, but functionally Booker can, it's only suicide at that point is it doesn't matter, right? Like, you know what I mean, if Elizabeth opened a tear at that point and had him hit by a train instead, like that would functionally achieve the same thing. It's a symbolic gesture,
would
rather
have been
than
so much cooler, right?
You know, and
fuck you,
like, Hong Kong.
But if you see the relationship between the two Bookers, I guess, as a little meditation on like what does it mean to symbolically wash away sin as opposed to actually atone for action, then that's kind of interesting, and it ties into maybe a bunch of the broader things of the game, which is, I mean, I would argue that the theme of the game is things people can accept without comment, even though it's happening right under their nose kind of thing. And that's, you know, the racism of Colombia as well, and the sense that Colombia is in itself exempt from, initially, in the way that America is, they said initially it would be about American exceptionalism, and that's the way that manifests, that America is exempt from the same rules that apply to everyone else. And then that when Colombia puts down the Boxer Rebellion and acts in a way that is saying we're exempt from the rules, we're just going to annihilate you, and then America gets rid of Colombia, that's actually probably the, you know what I mean, it's sort of all part of that theme of, you know, certain people or certain ideas are exempt by virtue of their symbolic existence as opposed to their actual actions. I said that was going to be previously the most pretentious thing I've ever, but I think this is going to keep happening. And alternate realities.
We should talk about the ghost.
Oh, yeah, there's a ghost.
Yeah, we should cover the ghost.
In fact, that was really. I was thinking we're doing that the intro to this podcast. We'd be like, let's talk about Bioshock Infinite, a game with a ghost in it.
Yeah, that's not the high point.
So, it's like we keep calling her a ghost, and that's kind of humorously flippant.
If it looks like a ghost and it sounds like a ghost.
I think it's worse than a ghost. It's not just a ghost. It is a manifestation of Elizabeth's dead mother, which has been imbued with all her feelings of resentment towards that person. She is a transdimensional ghost imbued with feelings.
That's the point at which I started laughing out loud at the lines of the dialogue that were not meant to be funny, such as, I don't think it's really her. I think it's a combination of herself and a manifestation of my feelings towards her. I'm just so angry.
angry at you, Ken Levine.
I think there were, you know, like that's
ghost
maybe
mom
a little
boss.
I could have
maybe ghost mom boss, but not really her mom.
If she hadn't been a ghost in all of the cliched ways that ghosts are represented in all other fiction, then I might have bought it.
Yeah, but it's like, summon zombies.
Yeah, well, mechanically it was a low point as well, since it's just kind of frustrating and annoying to fight. It's impossible to know when you're damaging her, really, because she's just a bullet sponge. Why would bullets hurt a ghost anyway?
Yeah, I was using the fucking chain gun.
I was using the hand cannon, yeah.
Like, over the sound of the bullets screaming to Elizabeth, sorry, I'm chain gunning your ghost mom.
Chain gumming your ghost mom.
Episode title.
Massive spoiler. Yeah. I mean the thing is, well, like in that simple plot idea, which is you think it's a manifestation of Elizabeth's mom, but it's actually something she's making up, is a kind of little kernel of an emotional truth, right? Like, so there's a nice moment there where Elizabeth isn't actually talking to her mother who she never knew. She's talking to her own ideas about her mother who she never knew, because that's how power works.
Yeah, and she defeats her with forgiveness, which ties into the whole... which she does. Like, your shitting her doesn't kill her, it just weakens her.
We
and
have
then
to learn to forgive each other. Only okay, I'll spit out.
But like, that works as a tragic plot beat, yeah, right? Like, without the ridiculous ghost. Like, if literally you got into the tomb, whatever, and Elizabeth had brought her mother back to life, or thought she'd brought her mother back to life, and then you'd found out a stage later that that's not what's happened at all, right? Like, you know, you sort of find gaps in her knowledge, or whatever, however you express that, then it's quite sad, right? That you realise that she doesn't have the power to bring people back to life. She has the power to change reality such as she wants it. And it comments, maybe justifies some of the other things happening in the plot.
So that wasn't the BioShark InfiniSharks jumping moment, was it?
That was one of them. That was one of them. There was kind of InfiniSharks.
But what was the earliest sign of Finn that you saw in the water?
To be honest, there was the earliest one was what one was actually kind of starting to have when I played it at the preview event, because the preview event got most of the way through Slate's plotline, but not all the way, and just the justification for you having to mow down that particular wave of people is he doesn't want them to be killed by tin men, so he'd like them to be killed by his friend who he otherwise has no beef with. This is the honourable death of my soldiers, is to have them attack someone I actually really like and get on fine with, rather than have them attack the enemy and make any progress towards defeating my enemy. It's much better for people, for really soldiers get killed in friendly fire is the most honourable way for them to die.
It felt very much like, oh, but we had mad mini bosses who dominated a single area in BioShock, why don't we have them here?
Yeah.
But there's no reason for that in Colombia, because in BioShock everybody's been stewing in this madhouse for years and years.
Taking
and years.
A drug that
and
makes
taking,
them
prick. Yeah, taking a drug which totally corrupts them, you know, physically and mentally.
Whereas
and
in Colombia they're just only taking racism juice. It doesn't have the same effect at all.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's I've gone thematically crazy. Like,
in this theme park, literally a theme park.
That was weak. But I assumed that you were going to say that the BioShark jumping moment was the point where you decide to destroy your own universe and go to a completely different one so you can find some boxes
to
easier?
Move some boxes.
And the classic line, oh, we didn't think this through. Yeah. Like, and also, luckily it's a portal here that solves this problem, and we're just going to assume it will be fine and that will be the
yeah, in a world where you have a sidekick whose main power is the ability to summon hooks. Hooks whose express purpose is to carry freight. They're freight hooks. You never use them for freight hooks any other time, but boy, Elizabeth,
one time
that would be an amazing time for a crane.
So all I got here is a portal to a universe where the rebellion is more successful and we're all screwed. But then, like, yeah, just even going through that, and then, like, as soon as you go through it, I mean, you, I guess somewhat to his credit, Booker and Elizabeth are both saying, hey, this is probably a terrible idea, you know, who knows what the hell we might be doing? This might completely ruin the world. Yeah. Yes!
It is the most spectacular you only live once moment.
I suspect that originally there was a much better explanation for it. I imagine it was that Elizabeth feels guilty for is it? I forget the name of the Chen's death, and she brings him back to life, because you see in the early trailers she can bring horses back to life temporarily. I imagine that's obviously something they cut, but I wonder
that
if
that was their main superpower originally. Then they added in the portals thing. I can bring horses back to life temporarily. It's not quite giving us the plot leverage we wanted.
Booker, you've got to kill this horse.
But I imagine they had a much more elaborate section there, which then presumably didn't work for one reason or another that they had to cut, so they just threw in some crates instead.
Well, I was thinking about this, like, I think I wondered if that was just a way of extending that section, because it's so kind of telling that you do that kind of press F to change reality twice within the Fink section of the game. And it does feel to simply extend. It's the only real weak point. Like, well, not the only, but like, it was a serious weak point that you find the dead gunsmith, and taking it as read that there aren't any other like rebel friendly gunsmiths around, it kind of makes sense that okay, the only way we're going to solve this problem is by changing reality, right? Bringing someone back from the dead. You know, the weakness of the second time you do it is that the problem you're solving is an entirely mundane problem, right? You know what I mean? You're not solving like a debt. You know what I mean? And I thought it was going to be much more important that you solved it by, like, changing his wife. Like, they swapped reality for a reality where he had married Fink's sister.
Oh, is that who she is?
Yeah, because it mentions that he got off because of who his brother-in-law was. Or something. Like, you can tell the rest of that story from that point, fine, right? That in the world where Chen lives, the rebellion does much better and starts. You don't need the extra step of, but they also took us, and then they got the tools back, and then the rebellion started.
Yeah, I had a couple of different problems. One is just like, it's at that point you are the furthest removed from your actual goal as you'll ever be in terms of adventure game logic. Of, oh, if I do X for Y, then they'll give me Z, and I need Z to do this. I ran out of letters there. That's so many.
Ironically, like, I think you end up hijacking an air balloon at some point during this escapade, and at no point does Booker think, why don't we just use this? We're in a ship.
Yeah, when you're flying up the Zeppelin.
Every fight, I take over like three different floating boats, like many hover boats. I have multiple hover boats commandeered. Yeah. Yeah. And but the only way we can possibly get out is to take this the first lady, the president's own Air Force One, is the only thing we can steal. And when that gets confiscated, well, the only thing we have to do is we've got to get it back from the person who's taken it. So we've got to do whatever they ask us to, even though it's not really relevant to what we want to achieve. And also, then when we come to the bit where we're going to open a tear in reality to go to a reality where the favour that we're supposed to do for them has already been done, why do we assume that's going to get us the airship? Yeah. We didn't do the favour. We're not there. We didn't do it. She'll be like, I never needed you to do any guns. I never said I'd give you an airship for that.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's all correct. And also, the other thing is that you stay in that reality for the rest of the game, right?
So it has a knock-on effect on everything. I kept thinking, well, if we weren't in this stupid fucking reality, maybe this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, but also, this is the thing I don't get. In that reality, they express that the reason Booker helped the rebellion and started the rebellion and then died was because Elizabeth was in Comstock House, not in the tower. Do you hear that audio diary?
Don't think so.
Right.
Or pay attention.
In that, when you find the audio diaries from Booker, from like alternate rebellion starting Booker, he says that the girl was in Comstock House, which is kind of the final location in the game normally, not in the tower. Therefore, he agreed to help the Vox because they would give him the power he needed to take Comstock House because he would never have been able to take it otherwise. Okay. So that's why he helps the rebellion in that reality.
What happens to Alterna, Elizabeth?
This is an excellent question, as is why the tower is half destroyed in that reality. Because the tower is shorn in half by Songbird when you rescue Elizabeth from the tower. And when you send Songbird into the tower at the end to blow it up, it is still, it's half the tower.
Half destroyed. Right.
Yeah, yeah,
that doesn't add up.
So that doesn't add up, unless I've gotten that slightly wrong.
You've been to magical future land as well, haven't you? And back again.
You've been to Elizabeth gets old and decides to bomb New York.
Yeah. Yep, that was pretty cool.
It's
insane, but
I was like, no, Elizabeth wouldn't do this, but it does look kind of awesome, so you're okay.
Yeah. There's also, I think the cage thing, the explanation of cage being C-A-G-E, is the only full-on Scooby-Doo movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Couldn't feature a little bit, but just been a bit clearer. Yeah. It's C and then A. And then yeah. Which brooch did you guys choose? Which necklace thing?
The bird. Who would choose the cage?
Me. because I knew everyone else would choose the bird. And I thought, I'm going to have any chance at all to find out what the consequences of this is. I need to choose it all. That's the same reason I killed all the kids in Bioshock 1. The reviewers are probably going to save them, so I need to find out what the alternative is.
I killed my girlfriend at the end of Far Cry 3.
Is there like a sort of support group for those of us who just do the most psychotic thing we can?
Did it bother you that didn't have an impact?
I was actually going to ask if it did, because I haven't figured it out. I've talked to lots of people who chose the bird, and I haven't figured out any differences yet.
Isn't it the central premise of the game that it doesn't?
I don't know.
But isn't that kind of the point that it's making about
things being different, but always
things
ending
being
the same.
Different and ending the same? That and it's all those weird questions the Lutesses ask, right?
Yeah,
they're all about. I was going to argue just figuring out which Booker they're getting. You know what I mean? And there are different Bookers, and some Bookers will do the cage, and some people take the bird, and that's one of the kind of less important ones because that's interesting. Like the way they respond to it, and then kind of move on. Like I don't really mind that it didn't. Given the payoff isn't a plot thing later on when Elizabeth looks down at her necklace and goes, "I love birds," and then I don't know whatever.
The reason I was thinking of it just now is that. It made the cage thing even weirder for me because, I chose the cage thing and it's right on her neck. I'm like, isn't there some connection there? why are you not even talking about this?
I was having the opposite thing. I didn't pick the cage thing. Maybe if I did pick the cage thing, there would be a picture of a bird there.
But I think that thought process in and of itself is the point, right? Like, it's there to make you doubt how
To me, it just seemed like they didn't record lines for this because they didn't know what would be around her neck. Like, it seemed weird that Elizabeth wasn't even referencing the fact that she had a cage around her neck when her future self had written the word cage on a piece of paper to her.
Maybe that's fair, but I would argue that the reason it's there is to make you have these doubts, and the fact that those doubts don't get resolved directly is not necessarily a failing of the story.
I didn't mind that so much. Elizabeth, what do you think of Elizabeth? Does she live up to the standards set by Alex's video game
I was saying this to Graham the other day, like, Alex isn't that good, really. Like, it's sad. She is, like, probably one of the best sidekicks in gaming, but it's sad that the standard is that low, really, that like, she's the high watermark. Because she's nice, and she's just, you know, a decent human being. She has some of her own thoughts and actions, but she's, you know, total goody-goody-two-shoes, completely straightforward, no real character flaws, ultra simple. And I kind of felt pretty similar about Elizabeth. She, like... Mm. I really disliked how mechanically she was completely subservient to you. Like, the way that... the only way she's allowed to use her abilities is when you directly order to, and it happens so quickly and instantaneously, regardless of what she's doing. Even if she's, like, swinging around on a skyline and doing this other stuff, it just feels like I have a portal gun. It feels like it has nothing to do with her. I just click on things and it happens.
But it needs to be instantaneous, really, doesn't it?
It does for game reasons, and I think that's one of the problems if you're going to have a male protagonist and a female sidekick, and then you want to make a mechanically important, you're going to have to put her in an assistant role, and it feels really disappointing to me.
I thought it was okay.
It sort of holds together when you know their father and daughter in a way. Like, it becomes like
that is
bring your daughter to work day.
When she
make your daughter throw you salts when you're fighting bad guys.
Because there's a moment shortly before you discover or begin to suspect that you're her father that she gets a new outfit change. She gets a wardrobe change, and it's a much more revealing corset. And I was like, oh, here we go. Right, you're doing so well up until now, and then suddenly busty Elizabeth turns up, and there's the camera is kind of forced into her cleavage, and then maybe within the next hour or so, you find out you're her dad, and you're like, ah, that's quite neat. I quite like that being made to feel awkward about.
I think it's baiting you.
Yeah, no, I think it totally is. I think that's entirely.
It's real. I had the same kind of groan moment that you did because she says something to that. Oh, all they had was this. There's only one garment in here, and it happens to be this.
Yeah, I have to say I didn't get to know Elizabeth nearly as well as I did Daisy Fitzroy, and I think that may be a weakness for the game because there's just loads more information about Daisy Fitzroy all over the place, and I quite got to like her and sympathise with her, and then suddenly you have to kill her. And I was like, surely we could just talk it out. She seems reasonably reasonable.
She's gone
until
thematically crazy.
Up until you go into the universe where she's gone thematically crazy.
Yeah.
That's also a joke. That's my main problem with the characters throughout. It's not that they are so much dissonant with your own actions. They're just dissonant. Because when you say that they can change to such a degree between worlds, then the kind of they stop being characters that you can really empathize with because they exist in just this endless possibility space between, you know, one end of the spectrum and the other. And I don't know. They would have to
pull off some much more meaningful interactions. I think they took a stab at solving that problem that wasn't entirely successful. Right. The solution to that problem is the feeling that, well, I don't really mind if there are a million possible Elizabeths. This one is mine. You know what I mean? And this is the one I'm attached to because of this thing that happened and this thing that happened. Mm. You know, I'll always be attached to this Elizabeth because of the time she saved my ass by throwing me a gun. Right. That's what that system is designed to make you feel, I think. Right. It's like, I've said this, we were talking about in the office, but she most often throw you a coin immediately after you've used a vending machine. Mm. Like, it's just one of the way the script works, right? That she'll happen to find money just after you've finished looking at a vending machine. And whatever system is generating that in the back end, obviously the intent there is to create a moment through systems where the player will go, oh man, I can't afford the upgrade. Oh, thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I'm now bonded to you forever and care deeply about everything that happens to you and specifically you.
I did have a great moment from those systems that was completely immersion shattering, but I really liked anyway, which is early on in near the Hall of Heroes, like in that kind of whole theme park type area in the gift shop. There's a heater replica. The heater's the fiery shotgun you get later on, and it's a weapon of the Rebellion, so it's not in the first half of the game, except that one replica. Mm-hmm. And if you take it, it's got really limited ammo, and there's no ammo for it anywhere, because no one else has one. But Elizabeth still uses her script for like, oh, he's low on ammo, I better throw him a new copy of his weapon. So she keeps throwing me heater replicas. She threw me like 26 of them over the course of the game, because there were just no other actual weapons.
To be fair, really magic, wish-granting reality powers.
Yeah. Exactly.
Actually, I was going to say, maybe I've come around to the choice between the bird and the cage, right? Like, maybe the only reason that's there is to allow you to customize your Elizabeth, literally, so that you know which one, like, you know what I mean? So you have a sense that that is a character you have, to help you feel an attachment to a particular version of a character who does exist across multiple realms.
Yeah, I told I think it was the guy who did the lead designer on episode 2, I was interviewing him about Alex and like the pair's attachment to Alex and stuff. I told him the story of Thedric the Exaggerator, which was my companion in the Knights of the Nine DLC for Oblivion. And Thedric is just one of your men. He's like your second in command. but mine glitched out so that his arms were always just holding out as if he was saying, like, I just caught a fish this big. And he'd just walk around, like, even in combat, it would just be stretched out. And every time he looked at me, he was, like, holding his arms out and just looking questioningly at me, like, I was crazy. I fucking loved that guy. Like, he was the only NPC in that whole game where ever, if he died, that was it. I had to reload an older save game and just make sure there was some way he could stay alive. Because that was my Thedric, and, like, no one else had that guy. Although probably loads of people did. But I was saying, like, with Alex, they should just have some randomised factors, like maybe for you, she smokes. Maybe for me, she's got a different colour hairband.
Yeah,
and I guess that's kind of what they're... I mean, one of the... probably not the reason they did that, but it's probably something they wanted to achieve.
I was going to say, I really liked Elizabeth, and I didn't have a problem with the fact that she only uses her powers when you direct her to. Although it somewhat undermines her as the strong female character everyone hoped her to be. I kind of understand that at the end of the day, I'm the protagonist in this game, and you want to give the player agency all possible opportunities. If it was a case of, you know, you got to a door and you couldn't open it until the NPC got there to do it for you, that's the bullshit we complain about on Call of Duty.
That does happen quite a lot in this game.
But I like that I can direct her to do it, so I still have some sense of agency, but she has skills which I don't have, which means that she is, although not functionally independent, is an independent person who, you know, isn't completely useless, basically. She's not...
Yeah, they achieve the goals of making her not useless and not annoying in combat, but I think in doing so, they make her just an assistant, basically.
And you only feel her absence when she's gone. Like, that maybe...
Yeah, you feel quite... Or I felt quite lonely any time that she wasn't there. Like, you know, I did like having her walking around and interacting with the world. And I did love moments like when you can go and pick up the guitar and she starts singing along and feeds the orange and stuff like that. That's all that stuff's brilliant.
Ain't no freight hook when she's gone.
And that is a technological leap forward from Alex as well, who can, you know, climb on things in very specific situations and, you know, remark upon things in very limited situations. She doesn't really interact with the world in the same way that Elizabeth does.
I like that she can ride skylines, and it's great if you're just using them in action, you ride on a skyline to get up somewhere high and then you jump off dramatically and she jumps up after you, and that's really cool. But if you're a weirdo like me, then I would ride them until I hit like a cargo crate and then you just stop. Like, obviously it would be natural for her to jump off, but she doesn't really want to do that because she doesn't know where you want to go. So she just waits on there after you, and we're both just like dangling there. She's like staring at me. This is all I was going to do.
It did seem like maybe they tried to have a bit of code which would have her try to work out where you were going to go so that she wasn't always running directly behind you. She would sometimes run ahead.
Combat, she does that.
Yeah, and it didn't always work, and sometimes she would get confused, she would go the wrong way, she would come back, or she would, you know, that kind of thing. But I like that there was that attempt.
She teleports a lot as well.
Yeah, that's somewhat immersion.
Yeah, I left behind in a lift. And then, right behind me. Yeah. It's like, fucking hell. Creepy Elizabeth.
But I think it's one of those things where they had to do it that way. Like, they worked so hard to make her not annoying, you know, and not a turret, which was the way they put it in the BAFTA thing, that if they'd given her a gun, like, the moment she starts stealing your kills, you probably start resenting.
By opening portals and making people fall off gun.
Yeah, I've opened another rift to the lava dimension.
Well, I think there could have been more kind of wacky.
Yeah, if she was sometimes, knocking people off the edge of the level, I think that would be great and hilarious. But I do wonder if it feels almost like a symptom of the same thing that, you know, saying I do really like Alex, but she feels like a character who's have all of her sharp edges rounded off to make sure she can't possibly offend anybody ever. And I think that's because, I mean, it is because Valve playtest this stuff, and when they find people who are annoyed by something, they take it out. And they even said that, like, when they're playtesting Left 4 Dead, if a female character nags you about something, people really fucking hate it. And if a male character nags you, they can, like, insult you while they're nagging you, and they're absolutely fine with it. Like, oh, he's a character. What a card. Oh, Bill, he's always swearing at me and calling you an idiot, and he's so funny. And then if Zoe, like, says, hey, maybe she'll be like, shut up!
People being assholes is not exactly its fault, but yeah.
I think she is a little bit less rounded off than Alex is, but I was conscious of the fact that she was tailor-made to appeal to me in every way from the very beginning as well, when you're walking through her creepy house looking through the windows and she's just being charming and smart and creative and dancing and
She's geeky. She likes locks and she likes, you know, she's a bit of romantic.
Why did they give her so much lock picking equipment? Given that she likes picking locks, prison, they want to keep it locked. There's like whole tools set out in her array.
I was going to suggest we talk about the combat, but I mean,
we can do. I mean, like, I was just going to talk on the, like, I think there are a few moments when Elizabeth's like edges work really, really well, and they are all scripted, which is interesting. Because I think they bend over backwards to make sure she doesn't annoy you during combat or whatever, which is important, right? Like, if she could die, that would be fucking awful. If you had to seriously worry where she was while you were zipping around and having on a skyline having a brilliant time, that would be fucking awful, even if she does occasionally make a weird decision.
You turn too sharply on a skyline, she goes flying off.
It just occurred to me that, given that the assumption with the way she uses her powers in combat is that she opens rifts to the same place in Columbia, but where something was slightly different, like there happened to be health packs here, or happened to be a turret here, or happened to be a hook here, why doesn't she just open rifts to the many realities where there aren't Columbias? And therefore people will just immediately fall to their deaths. Like, she has many realities to choose from. Or where Columbia was somewhere else.
But she seems to say, like, she can't really choose what they are. She just sort of finds them. And they are wish fulfillment, but only sometimes, only when it's...
Yeah,
for
no,
plot,
it was a serious... Yeah, it wasn't serious...
Within defined mechanical
parameters.
I mean,
it really baffled me the Paris rift she opens just before you rescue her. Because, like, she goes along with you because she wants to get to Paris. And you're the only way she possibly get to Paris. Except for that one time she did open a portal to Paris just before you rescue her.
I thought it was implied that she couldn't get through it.
Well, like, she goes through it. Because she has to jump out of it because the car's coming towards her.
It's also Paris in the future, so not... quite wishful from since she doesn't
know it's Paris in 1982 again. Return of the Jedi.
Revenge of the Jedi,
Which is the original title for Revenge.
Yeah, it's kind of it's weird in lots of different ways, because also all the other ones she opens seem to be spatially locked, like it's the same, like you said, it's the same location in Columbia, but it's in a different time, a different parallel universe, but that one's totally a different place.
It'd be interesting.
Full colour, or some of the others are black and white for some reason.
Well, the only other time she does that is when she transports you to Rapture at the end, which we haven't talked about at all yet. But
Good moment.
The one thing I was going to say is that it's one of the moments I was going to pull out. But like the moments when she, like, I do think the bit where you're chasing her and she like tries to, she blocks you with like the marching band and then the train and that stuff. Like
the balloons at one point. For fuck's sake, it's balloons! I can walk through these.
Not in that dimension.
Med balloon world.
Yeah. I did think that was really well, nicely done. And like the bit where they do give her autonomy to use her powers by herself did sell the idea of this character to me as someone who's absurdly powerful if unrestricted. Likewise, I love the bit when you rescue, when after the really heartbreaking bit where you're separated from her and you find out that you've been separated from for a long time, and you rescue her then from what is basically like chemical castration, essentially. Like the way that's said, it's horrible what they're doing to her. When you rescue her from that, and that whole sequence I thought was like brilliant. And you know, you talk about maybe she has been had her edges sanded off to make her super likable. The bit where you see the blind panic on the totally unarmed scientists who I bludgeoned to death.
I mean
you run into each of the command rooms to press the button and you don't have to kill them then, right? They're killed by the tornado that Elizabeth summoned into the room when you switch off the suppressor thing. But that whole sequence was kind of awesome, from her, like, you know, full-on wrath of god kind of Wizard of Oz thing, especially the Wizard of Oz reference where she takes you to that cornfield in Kansas and there's the tornado in the background. But then, like, there's a lot of dodgy wobbly Booker Elizabeth dialogue in that game, but the bit after that I thought was really, really nicely done, when she's like, I'm going to kill Comstock, I'm done with this, I'm just going to kill Comstock now. And Booker says, I'm not going to let you do that. And then she like goes to attack Booker with the tornado again. And then the response, because I'm going to do it for you, which is probably the best expression of him being her dad in the entire game as well. Like, I'm going to protect you from that. I thought that whole thing was just like, yep, that, you know, whatever you want to moan about the game in storytelling in other ways, that whole moment really got me, because it's just really sweet and but scary, and sells her as this kind of force of nature. As is when her turns white and she takes you to a different game.
Yeah. And then immediately after that sequence, you ask her to open a door and she's like, give me a challenge. Yeah. probably wouldn't say that.
She does that too when, just after you've had your falling out, and she's like begrudgingly going along with you, and then you ask her for a long and says, "Oh, give me something harder." The bit where you are transported into the future and Elizabeth is old and left alone, it was kind of similar to a lot of my feelings about the stuff towards the end. Beautiful and like amazing and fascinating to explore, and like the Boys of Silence obviously are, like, visually fantastic, that was all really cool. But I kept thinking, like, well, if you hadn't pulled me through a rift 80 years into the future, I could have saved you back then. Like, I was still there. I was on my way to save you. The reason you didn't get saved is you pulled me forward into the future to send me back into the past to save you.
Yep. But it was very affecting, I would argue.
Like, and yeah, so
I
that
felt
was my
gutted for that whole section. Like,
mm. Yeah, that was my roller coaster with the whole thing, was that like the individual scenes are so effective and so beautifully done, and so kind of they not only not just a case of presentation, but you know, the like you say, the themes and the emotions they're playing with are really powerful mm. stuff. And then I'd always be thinking, oh cool, and it's gonna make sense? Oh no. It's gonna be really
like,
powerful, but
yeah, you do
sense.
Have to do it kind of like You have to acknowledge the fact that she needed to take you in the future so she could tell you how to beat Songbird. That's the only way that makes
yeah,
sense. Like, so if you kept going along the bridge, Songbird would have just killed you.
But the
right?
mechanics of how she gets into that position to do that is...
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, the game justifies itself constantly by showing you spectacular things, and that makes up for the fact that, yeah, Elizabeth, yeah, I don't really buy that even as an old lady after all that stuff that she would now want to destroy New York for no apparent reason. Like, I don't really buy that, but fucking look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like all that stuff, yeah. And the kind of the dimensional topsy turvy stuff it has to go through to make you be Comstock and have that make sense. It's like, but it's, you know, I see what you were doing there. I see what you were saying. That's cool.
Yeah. The other line that made me laugh out loud was right towards the end when you've learnt to control Songbird and you've won the battle on the airship, and Elizabeth's like, oh, we've got to destroy the siphon. It's the only way we'll ever know the answers about this, about this, about my finger. I guess really logically the only way we're going to find out why your finger got cut off as a child is if we destroy that building with a giant robot bird. I'm with you on this. Let's do it.
Totally with her at that point. Actually, I thought the explanation for the finger thing wasn't as awful as I thought it might be.
What? I agree. Is our assumption that Elizabeth's powers come from the fact that her finger was cut off in a portal? Did that like infuse her with portal juice?
Or is there some other? Bits of her exist in different universes. I think that's it.
Okay, so the finger's left behind, and that kind of that gives her.
There's like a voxophone thing.
The universe doesn't like having its peas mixed with its porridge.
I have
no idea what that metaphor means, but it's been widely said that
I agree
that,
with the
that
universe
explains
that.
It.
Basically, it doesn't like when one thing from one appears in the other. Apparently, that means that
but
person gets
everyone else gets a nosebleed and dies. I mean, Elizabeth's powers are like Adam in Bioshock. They, as far as I'm concerned, they are just there to facilitate the story they decided to tell.
Yeah.
And, you know, they never explain why people have fucking plasmids, apart from the fact that it's necessary for, like, Xander Cohen and the plastic surgeon and everyone else to work in the way they do. So, like, you know, you can argue, oh, no, it's sea slugs, but that's not a very acceptable, that's not, you know, like, a satisfactory.
Ultimately, that kind of stuff doesn't, I mean, obviously it mattered to some degree, but it didn't diminish my enjoyment of that game sufficiently. Like, I mean, it's like you say, it's just a tremendous sequence of astonishing looking things.
Mm.
But I don't think it'd been bettered by really any film. Like, even like the kind of most outlandish CGI laden movies of the Wachowski brothers or Timur Bekmambetov, or those kind of visionaries.
Mm.
Like, nothing on the scale of Bioshock Infinite. I think we're way ahead as a medium. Suddenly.
A kind of recurring argument that one of the things that's great about video games is that they contain all other forms of media, that they are philosophy and politics and music and film. And I think Bioshock Infinite is probably the best, you know, example of that, because
not
it is a feast
coherently
across,
put together, but all you know,
like get all in there, cram them in.
It feels like a feast, and maybe not every plate is as delicious as the others.
One plate is ghosts.
To stretch this metaphor, but like the music, which we haven't really touched on, is amazing.
Yeah.
Like right from the off, with the barbershop quartet singing "God Only Knows" to the women singing "Fortunate Son."
I
did that all throughout the game.
Great,
you know, the recurring examples of girls just want to have fun and stuff like that.
Tainted love as well.
The old woman singing "Fortunate Son" when the rebellion starts. Like,
and I love that. Like in all those cases, it takes you a second to recognize it. Like you kind of think, "Oh, this is nice," and they think, "Oh, I know this," and they think, "Hang on, you shouldn't have this song."
And it's interesting. That's one of the things it just straight up explains as well. Like it's that audio diary where Fink says that they listened into other realities.
For all the big things they don't explain, some of the small things they explain really well. It's thoroughly covered.
Yeah.
You even find Albert Fink, don't you?
Do you? Where do you encounter him?
Yeah, in his apartment. Towards the end, when the city's kind of falling apart.
Hmm. Outside
and
the
there's
ghost
an audio
bit.
Diary of near the ghost.
It is near the ghost.
Yeah,
but
the ghost
he's not there.
He's dead. On the floor.
Is he? There's a corpse on the floor. And he's
I probably just looted
of...
his body, took whatever banana was on it.
We haven't talked about that.
Yeah.
My favourite thing with that is the box of chocolates you find around, which I've just like, oh, there's an orange and a sandwich in this box of chocolates. Okay, yeah. All the none of the boxes of chocolates have chocolates.
That we've gotten into that. We've gotten this far into a Bioshock Infinite podcast and not talked
about
that.
It has already become a meme though, so I think it's probably
the pear cupboard.
Yeah, like life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're gonna get. Sometimes it's a banana.
Gun bullets.
Yeah. God damn that. They need to, for the next Bioshock game, whatever it is, whatever they do Bioshock or the next game they make, I want them just to find a different way of giving you health back.
Yeah,
like, you know, the HEV, even though it doesn't make sense, there are HEV suit recharges everywhere in City 17. Well, they supposedly do explain it because it's like combine. Like charging pods that you can be repurposed to charge your suit or whatever. Yeah. They found an in-universe reason for why Gordon gets his health back sometimes, and I'm okay with that.
Well, it's like, you know, you're always suspending your disbelief. I mean,
Hungry Booker
says
is unacceptable.
That, you know, you should be able to suspend your disbelief about the amount of killing you do in these games. Why not a health system that doesn't annoy you? I mean, this doesn't seem too much of an ask, really.
What I don't like is...
generating shield, anyway.
I don't like the impression that I'm turning all of the other people into boxes, essentially. Like, it just, like, everything just becomes a container.
I'm going to kill you, and all that's going to be left of you is a box containing a peach. And then I'm going to fucking eat that peach.
Yeah. I'll eat the box. Out of respect to your family.
But even when they don't literally turn into a box, then they are essentially just
when
like
you're not
the
looking
system.
There, they all turn into boxes.
The system is just, like, you are just a container for things now.
It's because, like, you need to be able to suspend your disbelief, but then you need something to, like, to hold on to. Like, the rest of the rules of the world need to be sort of something you can relate to, like bullets go forward, some people in the past are racists, you know what I mean, like all that stuff. The idea that it's also one of the other facets of this parallel dimension is a place where a man can eat a vast amount of food incredibly quickly and it heals bullet wounds. Right, that is a premise of the game, whether you like it or not. It's one of its many ideas, is that, like, this guy, like, there's a bit in that section when you're in Emporia where you see, like, three guys who have been lined up against a wall and shot, and they're, like, blindfolded corpses.
Yeah.
And the first two...
looted them all.
The first two had nothing on them for me. We're like, okay, I get it. I've gone through... you know, in my head, I've rifled through their pockets, and there's nothing. The last guy had two rockets, some candy floss, and, like, 25 salts. And I was like...
Candy floss rocket Jones. Yeah, exactly. Died as he lived.
And nom. Like, I have no option to do anything, but nom. Like,
yeah, I think I've complained about this elsewhere, but that actually did significantly disrupt my enjoyment, probably, of the first part of that game. I think I did eventually get kind of, because I was just being inundated with a wealth of items and inventory, so I didn't really need to think about it by the end. But initially, all of that game's extremely effective scene setting and spectacle is disrupted by the fact that as soon as you go into a new arena, you make a beeline for the nearest bin. And no, but literally you do look at those environments and you start analysing them, not for the things that they're telling you symbolically, but for the things that are going to be useful to you immediately. And that is a problem. Like, it did distract me in a very negative way, I think.
It is done well in some areas. And like, again, to go back to the very start, in the sort of chapel with the water running through it. The only things you can take in that entire area, like, is the coins from the donation trays, which are up on certain altars. And
oh,
things.
Yeah.
And taking those coins does actually feel weird. Like, you know what
well,
I mean?
Well, at some point, he says that he goes into a shop and there's a lot of change. And he says, this is an honor system. And then you take all the money.
You can leave a coin in one of the shops. I'm not sure.
Can you
in every one. But there's in the donation box, if you use it. I was trying to steal the money, of course. But I accidentally clicked on the box itself and gave a coin. And he says, that ought to cover it or something like that.
It doesn't. It really
not the other
really
theft,
not
just
cover
that
it, when you set the city on fire.
Oh, I am going to destroy the whole city.
I have no problem with, like, being able to looking at the environment for what I can steal. I just want to be asked to think about it. And in that, and I think you're absolutely right, because you go through that whole, like, brilliant intro, and I felt a little bit like, for me, taking the coins from the altar bit at the start kind of established that this Booker is not a religious man, right? He doesn't have the fear of God, right? You know what I mean? Which is important for his character later on, etc.
Yeah.
And that felt right. To then walk out into Columbia and immediately eat an apple out of the bin says, like, who is this man? Like,
wait a minute. Yeah. You always had an idea.
Yeah. I think it works in Dishonored, which is also a similar game where you're eating lots of
cans of sardines,
crummy fish
products.
Which is delicious. But in that game, you're constantly looking at that environment for routes around it. It's a game about navigating that environment, and it gives you a much kind of deeper connection with that world, I think. Whereas in Columbia, for at least until Skyrolls turn up, you're not really looking at those environments as kind of interesting navigable spaces. So you end up concentrating on the wrong things, I think.
Did you guys cause any trouble in the non-hostile areas? So I went to an ice cream shop in not Hall of Heroes, but that area. What's the name for that whole like area? There are loads of different bits to it.
Oh, Soldier's Field.
Soldier's Field. I'd noticed it, no one was hostile, and that was great, and I was happy to play by the rules. But I just walked to an ice cream shop, just reached into the till and took all the money. Because that's just what I do. Like, I know there's money in tills. I want money, so I take the money. And then the shopkeeper was like, hey, I worked hard for that. And then drew a gun. And I had, like, my carbine out, so I blew his head to pieces. And then, like, everyone in the shop got scared, and guards ran in, and I fired crows at the guards, and the crows pecked the guards to death, and then also pecked all the civilians to death. And then I was, like, gunning down more guards. And then the last one came in, and I just switched to possession, so I used possession on him. And there's no one else for him to kill, so he just kind of stood there for a while. And then I think I actually did kill one of his, another guard that showed up, and then blew his own head off with a shotgun. And then Elizabeth, after that, is just looks up at me and like, do you want a coin?
I was looking through your screenshots that you took for the review the other day, Tom. And like 90% of them seem to be of people committing suicide. I don't know what that says.
That was for a box out. Okay, it was a box out on all the different
just
suicides.
To perfect that.
For a box out, I rated them on a tragicomedy scale from the most tragic to the most comic. Because at first, I was just horrified by this thing. I was like, oh, God, that's awful. You know, they're just like shooting themselves with the temples of a pistol, eating a shotgun. The machine gun one's sort of slightly sillier because they shoot themselves multiple times in the chest. And then like bonking themselves with their truncheon is sort of like, it's horrible and funny. And then
the rocket jumping
and then,
guys.
Have you ever done a sniper rifle guy?
No.
Their weapon's too big to shoot themselves, so they just beat themselves with their head. And then, the rocket launcher guys rocket jump, destroy themselves. And I thought that was all the way to funny.
Yeah. We should talk a little bit about the gear system. Because talked about the silliness of eating out of
reloading bins. Pants. That is the only time I aggroed people accidentally, is because I was wearing fire pants. when I jump off of a rail, I was just fooling around, jumped off, killed a whole bunch of civilians. Like, well, you know.
You will leave fire trousers behind your locked doors.
And then your hat electrocutes them.
Yeah, that doesn't really make any sense.
No,
because Booker isn't wearing a hat.
Yeah. And the idea of it's drawn as a top hat in the icon as well, the one I had. Electrocutes people. Top hat that electrocutes people. This is not the sort of treatise on racism that I was playing just now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Like, I was having this conversation with Tom Sr. earlier. This is horrible for beating myself, but I think it was about, like, that when you go up, he was suggesting that when you go up through Fink's kind of factory and you see the vending machines being made and you see all the kind of other things and the handymen and whatever, you should see the level of the floor, which is pants. Like,
and the pants.
Pants. But like, and in the background of that floor, there should just be a full-on wizard, like Gandalf, stood there, like magicking the pants as they go past.
That would have been awesome.
Just to explain it, right? And then never address it again. Why do we have magic pants in the Flying City? With the quantum physics Flying City? Because of this wizard. The end.
Mechanically, the way that progresses was also slightly unsatisfying. I wonder if the game suffers from having things cut from it and a matter of rebalancing, because during the game, the first pants that I got pretty much were the best, most useful for me. Mm. And they didn't seem to be, again, with the vigors and stuff, and also the guns, there didn't seem to be a very good incentive for you to explore the other ones once you'd perfected one combo. And in fact, because the way you upgrade them incentivizes you not to change.
We were talking before about Tom was saying that there was originally a multiplayer mode that they cut because it just wasn't working.
Right.
And it sort of feels like a lot of those systems, you know, would have worked better in a multiplayer thing. Mm.
It'd be annoying to be eaten by crows in multiplayer, I think.
On the crows thing, that I think is the more egregious example of people who are mental for no apparent reason than Slate in the Hall of Heroes, is that section you go through early on where you get the people who worship John Wilkes Booth and like the demon Abraham Lincoln thing, and like they dress like clan members with coffins on their back and they shoot crows out of their hands for no real reason as far
it's
as
an
I can tell.
Universe, man. It explains everything.
But like, but look, given that they've established that not everyone in Columbia is fucking, they're racist, but they're not insane.
Shock Jockey is used to power fundamental parts of Columbia's infrastructure, and the crows guys just like crows. What's wrong with you? What's
we like
with
John Wilkes Booth and crows.
Yeah.
That's our thing. Can we have a flying building, please? I was like, yes. Do what you like with it. Go crazy. Set some traps. Make sure it's only progressible in one linear way and you can go
hide
back quickly.
Hide some pants that help you reload in a bookcase. Yeah. Yeah. That's where I got
it's
mine.
It's like you go to like your first day in Colombia, you go up to like the theme registration office. Like, I'd like to register assassins and crows. Oh, cool. Yeah. Don't give the same two nouns as someone else.
Spoons and ghosts, please. Yeah. Yeah.
I really liked the enemies with no eyes in the rooms with the little kids with the George Washington masks.
Oh, yeah.
With yeah, the, Boys of Silence.
Boys of Silence, yeah.
Although, especially, don't fucking... Sorry.
I was going to say, especially for the moment when you go up to like this blurry CCTV screen and you pull a lever to open the door... And then when you turn around, there's one directly behind you.
The old four-folic trick.
Yeah, the old four-folic trick. Shit myself.
And Bioshock 1 does that a couple of times, but I think Infinite only does it this once, and I shit myself as well. Like,
what about
hands and mouse off the, off the desk. I'm like, whoa!
The thing that creeped me out the most was the head in the wheelchair that rolls in front of you.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's pretty good.
Because that was genuinely... The Boys of Science, I'd encountered them before, and I'd kind of lost my fear of them by that point because they don't really do anything. They just make the other guys angry, and those guys were quite easy to deal with, so it wasn't that... Like,
were they? I thought they were really tough.
I was having
a I had so many good crowd control things by then, but that if you had, like, 10 people in a room, it was the same as having one person in a room because they would just set fire to them all with crows.
Yeah, I think I spread my bets with Vigors and then didn't use them.
Well, actually,
so that was the worst possible compromise.
Craig Owens had an even better setup than me, I think, and he found that bit completely trivially easy. He got a bit of gear that I never found, which if you get excess damage on a critical hit, like more than you need to kill someone, it spreads to everyone nearby.
Oh, wow.
And he had he would like throw crows at people to disable them, and then I think electrify them, and then headshot with like an upgraded sniper rifle or something. And because it did so much damage, it just killed everybody around at the same time, which sounded quite cool.
I was completely out of ammo by that point and completely out of salt. And so setting off those guys was real pain. Cause and also, I really miss Elizabeth because it's like she can't magically fix one of those problems.
So what I was going to say was I watched a video diary about what the Boys of Silence were before the game came out, which is why I know what they're called. And the whole concept for them was they couldn't see anything, but they could hear really well. And like the Hydra in Half-Life, and it was supposed to be like, you know, you have to worry about a different sense now. So the first like 9 times I tried to get past one, I just did it completely wrong because I was trying to make no noise and go really quietly. But no, they can just fucking see. They can see, but they can't hear.
They have massive trumpets on their ears.
And yeah, look at them. They've got giant ear trumpets and no eyes. Apparently they can see fine, but not hear.
I think the entire of this game and how effective this entire sequence is testament to the fact that the artists just had a really long time to work on the game while the designers fucking tore themselves apart and saying, no, Ken, we can't have a modular flying city that reassembles itself. We can't do it. But it all looks amazing.
Yeah. I like how you get the explanation for the city that, oh, it's held up by quantum physics. They're like fixed points in space-time, so it can't move up or down, right? You know what I mean? When you move it, it moves. But it is also balloons and propellers.
I found it weird. I was feeling all satisfied with my understanding of the world when I sort of when I was previewing, actually playing the first 5 hours, I was kind of thinking about all the weird things I'd seen and all this like future technology and songs that didn't belong in that era and all this other stuff. And then the main guy you're trying to fight keeps calling himself a prophet, and then there's these portals that when you rescue Elizabeth, so you can go to different times, and then suddenly go, oh, of course, so portals can go to different times, so he's used the portals to get technology from the future and from other dimensions and stuff, and so that's why the city is floating. But no, apparently they invented quantum levitation before the portal thing. This is totally
that is no, but the portal things are because of that, like because of Lutece, right? Like, isn't
it's the same inventor, yeah, but it's not like they didn't get the floating thing from the portals. Because they invented portals after the Columbia was already flying around the world.
Yeah, but isn't that because it was the making something that could fly using quantum physics? I mean, the big weakness here is the fact that an inventor happened to exist in 1893 who was capable of this thing, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever, 1997. But with that benefit of the doubt given that Lutece existed, female Lutece existed, Lutece from that reality existed, then just, Lutece followed, right?
Yeah, but it's weird to me that if you're going to have like an incredible, phenomenal technological discovery that's way outside of its time and way futuristic, that also happens to be able to explain any other subsequent discoveries.
Mm.
It's weird that you have that one be the second one.
It's weird. It's this weird chicken and egg thing. Yeah, it's like what came first, quantum physics or the power to reach into the future and find Cyndi Lauper? We haven't really talked about combat, apart from talking about the Vigors themselves. I was interested in knowing whether people swapped between weapons throughout the game or settled on two for the entire thing, because I settled on two for the entire thing and didn't change at all.
I experimented very briefly and then decided not to do that in future because it hobbled me for a period of time.
Yeah.
And because there was no ammunition for that particular weapon, and I had already upgraded the carbine. So as soon as I found another carbine, I switched back again. And it slightly annoyed me because I couldn't tell what any of the fucking guns were anyway, because they have stupid names that don't describe what they do.
Well, they're the ones that do describe it. I mean, there seems to be like three or four machine guns that do almost exactly the same thing. Repeater and burst repeater, and then what's the other one that sounds like repeater?
Heater?
No.
Burst gun.
Yeah, the burst gun, repeater, carbine. Machine gun are all pretty similar. And then, yeah, carbine, sniper rifle, and hand cannon are all fairly similar in function.
Yeah, I kind of spent half the game switching through different weapons because it took me that long to work out whether any of the ones you find later on were any good or not. And by that point, I feel like I kind of missed out on being able to upgrade a couple of them to their maximum. Like, I spread my upgrades across, and so just had constantly found myself in situations where I was out of ammo. There was only one type of weapon around I could pick up, but I hadn't upgraded that one at all. And I don't know, I just felt like I fell into this trap of I'm not sure whether I specialised too much or didn't specialise enough. Or
I felt like the two weapon system really didn't suit this game. It just felt like...
Yeah, even if you'd had one extra weapon slot, you would have been free to experiment. Because the problem is, with the game, all the systems act towards cementing your original decisions to some extent, because the most versatile weapon combination is some kind of heavy weapon, like an explosive, and then a range weapon. And that means that you're never really given the incentive, unless you make a really conscious decision to use charge in a shotgun, for example. That's a really good combo.
That's what Rich did. Like,
yeah, but you have to make that choice, right? Sure, in a big way, and you can't just dip into that. You need to completely reassemble your entire arsenal in order to experiment with that, because you don't want to be in a situation where you end up with a shotgun and no way of reaching enemies. Mm. You know, you need to swap out all of your vigors and stuff like that, basically.
I started to realise that... I was having this problem where I can only carry two weapons, and which the best weapon was tended to vary quite a lot, and I needed to change my weapon quite a lot, so didn't seem to be much point in upgrading the weapons, particularly when they cost the same type of money that upgrading your plasmids does, your vigors. And your vigors you always have with you all the time. You can if you upgrade one, it's always going to be useful forever, so I just spent all of my money upgrading vigors.
Yeah, I kind of knew I was going to sit with the hand cannon and the carbine, so that's all I did for the entire game.
Really? You used both of those? Because they're both, like...
They're similar, but the hand cannon is I would argue probably the best weapon in that game by miles. That you can two shot a
creature. Yeah,
I and I was playing on hard as well, so it's kind of once I knew something that worked, I stuck with it. I swapped out the carbine for a sniper rifle sometimes, but it's on ammo.
Apparently, the sniper rifle is really good if you fully upgrade it. I started to realize at first I thought that was kind of pointless because I really liked the carbine and it was already accurate and already long range and already decent damage. But I think the sniper rifle does loads of damage and is good for handymen, like if you shoot them in the heart with that. I'm guessing that is
I used to have the hand cannon. The thing is as well is that it's funny, I thought stuff like the rocket launcher and the minigun changed the tone of the combat in a way that was sillier than whipping around on a hook already was. Something about having a rocket launcher, deeply silly in this kind of way that I sort of rejected by refusing to use it.
I use those constantly, especially for taking down the kind of bullet sponge enemies like the handyman and stuff like that. So I was always carrying one weapon that was like that.
Yeah, that's right. I used up that weapon slot, basically.
I used to do that, and then I noticed that it was quite common for there to be a tear that brings through a chain gun or brings through a rocket launcher or something. So I thought, oh, fuck it, I won't take one then.
The alternate dimension where everyone keeps a rocket launcher on their mantelpiece.
They're mounted above their fireplace. Yeah. That seems to be a really common thing.
They killed this rocket launcher and mounted it.
But in terms of the combat overall, I think I was saying this in the office earlier, there's obviously been some kind of backlash against the game saying, wouldn't this be so much better if there was no combat in the game? And for a start, I don't think I was so wowed by the profundity of the fiction that I don't think it deserves a kind of schlocky combat core. And also, not only is the combat really good, I think, in this game, but if you didn't have the combat, then you would need to have some kind of extremely rich, concentrated period of interaction where you're interacting with the environment and other characters in a way which has never yet been invented in games. So I think it's kind of a slightly desperate expectation. But even if you concede that the combat is a grudging necessity, I think it was pretty fucking great in this game. Yep. As soon as you got the sky rails and stuff like that,
yeah,
it felt terrific. And initially you're kind of quite static, but as soon as it gives you the kind of affordances to get around that place,
yeah,
it was tremendous.
I love it when there's hover boats moving around, because they do seem to eventually settle on a position, but there's sometimes quite a long time when they're just kind of touring the whole space, and you can jump from a sky rail onto a moving platform, beat those guys up, jump off onto another sky rail, and you know,
yeah,
keep moving around, and the whole battlefield is changing as you're doing it. That was really cool. Did there was only one airship battle other than the end, right? Where you could actually board the airship and take it down.
The full Zeppelin, yeah.
Yeah. Did you say there's two?
Yeah, there's one. You blow up a Zeppelin, mm-hmm, and then you commandeer the Zeppelin at the end.
Yeah.
I
didn't know.
Yeah.
Because one of the first videos they showed that as being kind of almost like an emergent thing where enemies would try and run to the siren thing, and if they sounded the siren, the giant airship would come up, and then you could hijack it and destroy it.
Yeah. Well, there were many, many promises for Bioshock which did not come out. I mean, for the modular stuff, the fact that Elizabeth's powers would hurt her and she could resurrect horses temporarily, which is obviously the most important thing in any game. Mm-hmm. And also the idea, in fact, there was an idea that when you summon a skyhook, there's a door behind it, usually in the model. Those used to be openable. You used to be able to go through one of those doors and come out somewhere else, which I think would be... I don't know quite why they got rid of that, because that seems really, really cool. And probably not that mechanically difficult.
Given that
to
the mechanics for coming out of a door back into the level are already in place.
Yeah. Mm. But I mean, obviously, I don't find that disappointing that those things aren't there on the whole. Like, I would want for some more interesting ways of using tears to, like, you know, summon trains, knock people off the world, or just outlandish things. I mean, you're looking into infinite fucking universes, right? And it seemed to be full of fucking freight hooks.
Yeah. Like, that would have been, like, for every environment or every significant combat to encounter, to have, like, one
crazy
big, crazy, one-use tear in it.
Yeah.
Right? Not a recharging tear, but, like, something. Like,
yeah, because that would actually give some interesting decisions to it as well. Because I found, like, the tears... most of the time, there was just one that was really good. It was just, like, with, like, a giant robot thing on my side, all the time. And if I need the med kits, I'll switch to the med kit one briefly, and then I'll go back to the giant fucking robot.
Yeah.
So it's really just like I have to press the use key one more time to pick up the med kit.
You can't think of a way to do it. It's well, frustrating. Like, imagine if you had like one of those areas with like aerial enemies flying overhead, and you could see there's a tear in the air, and if you highlighted the tear, it had some way of saying that it will do a lot of damage in this direction, but it won't tell you what it is. Like, you know what I mean? There'll be damage this way, just to avoid the spoiler for when you do it and a jumbo jet flies through and wipes out a thing. You know what I mean? Like, that would be fucking awesome. Man.
The big ones could like take her longer to open or something, so you need to invest it in like...
Or just timing, right? You know you can at once summon one big chunk of damage here.
Yeah. If you're having a jumbo jet crash into the player, it could totally transform it as well, you know, change the whole space. That'd be awesome.
Let's backseat design by
I think
they did a really good job of taking evidently years and years of multiple different ambitious ideas and crafting them to something that still feels whole.
Yeah, no, I don't feel it feels the combat feels really quite tight and coherent. I don't feel the loss of those things apart from, you know, the promise of the fiction. It does lend itself to slightly more outlandish things, but in terms of the mechanics of combat, thumbs up.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Anything with a great sense of like vertical movement in a game like that, I really love.
Incidentally, with that first Zeppelin crash, this is how I resolved that. I couldn't find the exit, and then I died. And then I was brought back to life after the Zeppelin had crashed, and Elizabeth turned around to me and said, "That was amazing!" And I was like, oh, fuck. So how do you get off it?
You fall onto a skyline.
Where was the exit? I went back to the kind of wings.
The bomb bay.
I couldn't jump over the little...
The bomb bay opens underneath you and you can drop to a skyline.
Oh, I didn't notice the bomb bay. I'm a moron.
I didn't go through the bomb bay. There's both of the balconies when I went out there. I can't remember if I jumped over the railing, but I got a prompt to jump onto a sky rail. Like if any of the sky rails you look at, sometimes it doesn't come out straight away because you're too far away, but I was like waiting on it as it was falling down. Like, yeah. I can probably jump for that.
I was running back and forth from either side because I'd be like, oh, the sky rail's going out. I'm going to go back to the other side.
The funny thing is, well, especially because like the explanation for how what happens when you die, like my internal explanation for that is that
it
switches to a reality where Booker didn't fuck it up.
Meanwhile, in another game where Booker didn't do that,
where Booker wasn't a cretin,
exactly. And so, but the idea that reality still exists, where Like, this is a Booker that went, like, you know, Booker died. No, I am Booker DeWitt. Booker! And it's because they're cheering your name as the Zeppelin goes down. Like, Booker DeWitt! Booker DeWitt!
I think
Booker
that was his DeWitt. Brother Marsh DeWitt, his, his stupid sibling. Yeah. Crashing in flames.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels weird when Elizabeth resurrects you in some of those times. The, like, that's not what happened.
And the little sister reference when she holds up the green syringe. Mm. She's dressed like a little sister. Yeah.
Also, like, if you just jump off Columbia, it just puts you back with no explanation. Like, we're not gonna have cutscene. That just didn't happen. Just shut up.
Yeah, at least
you didn't do that.
At least it's got its own. At least it's got a reason for doing that. Like, I mean, I kind of, because it's funny, when I first played Bioshock, a game I loved, I hated the respawn mechanic, and I know it's explained by the twist, the Vita Chamber thing, because I thought it was bullshit. Right? It was like it was a stretch too far for the fiction for me that this would work, because I still believed in, like, spoilers for Bioshock. Jack was the outsider, right? Like, how the hell, like. They went as far as in the fiction to explain that this is sort of banned technology, or that Ryan had centralized it and kind of all this stuff. And obviously they explained that for the twist. So because of that, I refused to use it. Like, every time I died, I would load a save rather than respawn.
That's mad.
Yeah, that's mad.
Yeah, I am mad. But, like, but no, because that, for me, that held it together better. And then in Infinite, I was really, like, the moment, the first time you die and you get that kind of just scene that happens the first time, well, because, like, what the fuck? And then walks back out through the door into wherever he left. So that was really well done. And after that, I was like, okay, I get this. Right. Like,
this one makes sense.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But, like, we had this conversation once, actually, while walking back from lunch, about what wouldn't it be weird if we lived in the best of all possible worlds and our own, like, consciousness moved. This is like a very short walk back from boots. But, like, what if your consciousness was always moving into a different version of yourself? Where something terrible didn't just happen to you. Because we were crossing a road, and I was like, there's probably a reality where I've just been hit by a car, but I've just decided to move sideways into the reality where I haven't. And, like, which is the infinite, which is the Bioshock Infinite respawn mechanism.
I was
quite pleased to see it make a cameo appearance.
Whenever I finish a really hard game, I always wish there was a button I could press to just watch all of the canon bits put together, like all the bits where I succeeded and didn't reload a million times, just chained together. So, like, that first part of the level I did fine first time. The second part, it was actually my 7th attempt that I got it right, so you just show the 7th attempt of that bit, and then the next bit where I took 13 attempts is just the 13th attempt of that bit, and then chain them all together into this one perfect playthrough where I just seem totally prescient and I know everything that's going to happen.
All games should be Super Meat Boy.
All luck goes that way.
Super Meat Boy. Like, have that, but with Booker DeWitt, so you just see all of the different Bookers run into a level and then split off and, like, do different things. That'd be awesome.
And does it as well, where you're always getting replays, but it takes you 300 attempts to finish a level, and then the last attempt is this perfect thing where you're predicting when the laser is going to hit you and the rocket's going to go here. And
neither of those games have saving or loading mid-level, so you, like, it's not piecing together your best run. It's actually a run that you did get to see in the first place. Mm. So it's the games where you never get to see the good run because it was so split up from obsessively quick loading.
Did you feel the lack of quick save?
No. I thought the checkpointing was fine.
Yeah, me too.
That was the only point where I would have had a wish for a check. A quick save was when I missed out on whatever was going to happen with that Zeppelin crash, because I'm more.
Well, there's kind of two things. I think in terms of, like, difficulty and, you know, punishing you for your failure, I'm fine with the way Infinite hands it. I'm especially respawn, and it's good because the things you achieved are still achieved. But I do wish at quick save, or even just an auto save that would auto save where I fucking left off. Because sometimes I have to close down the game and do other things, and sometimes I lose quite a lot of progress from doing that. It really irritates me, because it's not technologically an unsolved problem. I'm angry about it at the moment, because Walking Dead did to me recently, where I just lost, like, so much conversation, like about 8 different conversations that went on for a long fucking time, and I lost it just because I had to quit, I had to close down the game and do something else. And it meant that I kind of don't want to play it anymore. They almost killed the game for me. Because it's, like, particularly with dialogue stuff, I don't know, that's even more grueling than repeating combat. At least combat's kind of fun in itself, whereas dialogue, once you've heard the dialogue, you don't really... And I don't want to choose different options, because I chose the options I chose the first time around because they were the right ones.
Something we haven't really spoken about that kind of bring us to a close relatively soon, but we haven't really spoken about Rapture being in it.
Or Songbird's Death, which Songbird's is Death. Probably one of the greatest moments in video games, I thought.
Yeah, I thought. Like,
I was much more touched by Songbird's relationship with Elizabeth than I was with my own relationship.
Yeah,
well, that was a great level.
One of those, like, reserved twists in my head was Songbird is another Booker. Like, you know, because they talk about the handymen being men who've been kind of moved into these
bodies. It's actually, when I finished it, I was like, oh, it's weird that they didn't explain what Songbird was at all.
He gets drowned as well.
There's an audio diary outside Fink's office that I thought was talking about Handyman, but then when I went back and played it again, it's sitting next to a diagram of Songbird showing like how it works, and when you listen to it knowing that, it's like, oh, it's talking about Songbird. So it's a man and a machine. It's
but who was the man?
Well, Tony Ennis, a very observant sub-editor of PC Gamer, noticed that Andrew Ryan is called Andrew Songbird.
No, he's not. Sander Cohen.
Sorry, Sander Cohen. What a fucking moron I am. Yes, yeah.
Sander Cohen. Fucking your Zeppelin. Back.
Burn me. Crash and burn. Yeah.
Songbird is his middle name, or is that a nickname?
His nickname, Sander Cohen's nickname is Ryan Songbird.
Oh, Ryan Songbird, I see.
Yeah, like, Sander Cohen is Ryan Songbird in Bioshock. So, Songbird is Sander Cohen?
I'll take the other Songbird, the giant mechanical.
No, I think the Booker theory sounds up better symbolically, doesn't it?
Just another Booker from another reality. Like, all the failed Bookers become Songbird.
But it is, in Fink's diary, it's his idea to have Songbird protect Elizabeth. He's like, maybe we can get this, maybe we can make a machine that will protect Elizabeth.
An awesome machine that's kind of like a diving suit and also a bird.
it's so, like, so fucking weird.
Who do you think you're going to play as in the DLC?
Sander Cohen in a Songbird suit.
I think you might end up playing as a handyman or something. That would be a neat kind of mirroring of the Bioshock 2. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I was totally convinced that Booker was the Big Daddy analog, right? Partly because his BD is his initials. And that was going to, you know, because you're the one protecting the little sister, or, you know, in that case. And so it's kind of Songbird's part in that analogy is kind of the weird bit, I think. It's if Songbird is the Big Daddy, then.
I loved that you went to Rapture, but I partly wondered before that point whether you would end up there through a tear. But I was also wondering if there was more connections to the original Bioshock, just because Elizabeth is quite little sisterish at points in how she looks, and you boost her into a vent, and when she's holding the giant pair of scissors and stuff like that, it looks an awful lot like she's a little sister with a syringe, and you boost her through a vent.
Helping women
to
fence is just video games.
I don't know whether all these callbacks necessarily are going to have like a neat
reason.
I think some of them are just mirrors and symbols.
Yeah, I think that was just
did anyone else try and search the bins in Rapture? can't. It's the only bins you can't serve. Because then they'd have to have Rapture food in there. There's no way they could survive.
Maybe to make one final really wanky point then.
Take us on home, Chris.
Yeah. About those like mirroring, right? About that kind of the sense that what I think that does in a way that's actually, I think, genuinely pretty cool, is it allows Infinite to kind of comment on the original Bioshock a little bit, right? Explicitly, right? We're going to have some of the same ideas, we're going to bring them back and rearrange them in a different order. Like, Bioshock's huge weakness is what happens after Would You Kindly, and it's to Infinite's credit that it saves its Would You Kindly moment for the very end, when you're already, like, you can see very clearly that you're at that point kind of literally tumbling through all the kind of crazy ideas the game is throwing at you. It doesn't then ask you to play for another 3 hours, having already undermined all of the different having undermined the concept of linearity, it then asks you to keep going. And I thought that one thing that was really good about the ending of Infinite and its whole, all of its ideas about what it means to kind of be on one deterministic course through the world as opposed to millions of others, when you walk out into the sea of lighthouses and all that stuff, is it kind of goes back and solves the problem from the end of Bioshock in a way that, like, if your playthrough is simply your playthrough and you're the guy who didn't throw the baseball at the guy, but chose the cage, but did this, but did that, but did that. And then what's unique and distinct to you is your course through it, not the ending you got or anything else.
Yeah.
And that then helps to justify, for example, the multiple endings of Bioshock. They both happened. The linearity of the end part of Bioshock 1, or the existence of Bioshock 2 in a way, which was the kind of, you know, it's kind of semi-non-canon in a bunch of ways because it wasn't made by Irrational and all this stuff. Like, it kind of brings all those things together in a way, like the franchise itself kind of goes, actually, you know what? It's fine that all these things exist and your experience is your own. Go for it. Now drown. because we can't think of another way of ending this. Also, then post-credits bullshit.
Yep. Fill this room with water and we're done.
Yeah. Let's go and get some post-credits bullshit for ourselves.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Going back to the office. That's our post-credits bullshit.
To build our great big thematically mad challenge stage. What would our nouns be?
Sorry?
What would our nouns be? Like crows and John Wilkes Booth?
It would be like free t-shirts and mini sliders.
And paper mache tanks.
USB sticks with a small number of screenshots on them.
Be a fairly poor area in whatever video game we've got on.
Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Yes, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Click.